Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Into the Killing. If you have a case you want to suggest for our podcast or for our YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com, then go to the Suggest a Case page. For today's episode, we're going back to November 1989. In the NBA, there were some major changes. Two expansion teams played their first games, the Orlando Magic and the Minnesota Timberwolves. On November 3rd, the first two Soviet players, Alexander Volkov and Shrunis Marshalonis, played in regular season games. Volkov played two seasons for the Atlanta Hawks. Marshalonis is considered one of the best international players of all time. He played for seven seasons in the NBA and was inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. On November 7th, the East German Communist government resigned. On November 9th, 1989, the border between East and West Germany opened for the first time since 1961. The border restrictions were just supposed to be relaxed, but the spokesperson misread the notes and said that the borders were open immediately. Thousands of people climbed over the Berlin Wall to reunite with friends and family they had not seen in decades. The next day, the wall was demolished by demonstrators. It was one of the most pivotal moments in the 20th century, and it was a major event in the fall of communism in Eastern and Central Europe. On November 3, 1989, the number one song in the United States was When I See You Smile by American-British glam metal supergroup Bad English. It was their only number one hit. The number one movie was the romantic comedy Look Who's Talking. The movie, which starred Christy Alley and John Travolta and featured the voice of Bruce Willis as the inner thoughts of the baby, was enjoying its fifth week at the top of the box office. On Monday, November 13, 1989, 16-year-old Amy Widener wasn't feeling well. She had a sore throat, so she decided to stay home from school that day. Amy lived in a quiet neighborhood in South Indianapolis, Indiana. Amy was not your typical 16-year-old girl. When she was 14, she became pregnant. She kept the pregnancy a secret for 5 months by wearing baggy clothes. When she finally told her family, they were supportive. Amy decided to raise the baby. Amy and the father of the baby, Joseph Ellerton, broke up before the baby was born. On October 25, 1987, Amy gave birth to a girl, Emily. 6 days after giving birth, Amy was back at school. One would think that juggling high school and a baby would be difficult. But Emily seemed to inspire Amy to do better in school, and she was an honor student. After graduating, Amy planned to attend Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Her mother thought she was going to be a French teacher. Amy and Emily lived with Amy's mother, older brother, and two younger sisters. Her mother had been divorced from the children's father for several years, and he lived in Florida. On the morning of November 13, 1989, Amy and Emily were home alone. Amy's mother, Gloria, tried calling several times, but didn't get an answer. So she went home and found 2-year-old Emily on the landing of the stairway. She was unharmed. Gloria put her in a pack and play and then went looking for her daughter. She found her nude, dead body in her bedroom. She was lying face up on the bed. There was blood splattered around the room. She had a large cut on her head. Gloria immediately called the police. The police found a handprint in Amy's blood on the wall. However, the fingerprints were smudged. But there was a clear palm print. The problem was, at the time, there was no database for palm prints. The police also found what they believed were traces of semen on her bed sheets. They collected the samples of the semen. Amy's neck had severe bruising. It was later determined that she had been strangled to death. It was also clear that Amy had put up a fight before she was killed. One thing that the police noted was that all the violence appeared to have happened in Amy's bedroom. So the police thought she knew her killer. There were no signs of a break-in or forced entry. The police thought that this further confirmed their theory. They thought that Amy had let the killer into the house and they went to her bedroom. She possibly turned down his sexual advances and he snapped. But the more the police looked around the house, they became unsure about that theory. For example, if Amy had to guess, she probably would have put Emily in her crib or pack and play. The police found out that the back door was unlocked. They learned from the family that they rarely locked that door. So the police thought that the killer may have entered the house through that door. Then, Emily's brother discovered that a $50 bill and a piece of stereo equipment called a graphics equalizer had been stolen from his room. Also, some money that was in the kitchen had been taken. The money had been in a jar. Amy had been selling chocolates for several weeks to raise money for new band uniforms. This led the police to another theory. The killer broke into the house, planning on robbing it, found Emily, and ended up raping and killing her. The police talked to the neighbors, and they didn't see anything unusual that morning. So the police thought that the killer may have been familiar with the neighborhood and the family's home. For example, a piece of stereo equipment in a bedroom is an odd thing for a burglar to steal. Most burglars take things that are out in the open and easy to carry. So the police thought that the killer knew that the graphics equalizer was there before they broke into the house. Also, the killer probably knew the family's routine. He most likely broke in on a Monday morning because he believed that no one would be home. Then, he was surprised to find Amy there. The police started going through a list of likely suspects. The first one was Amy's ex-boyfriend and the father of Emily. He had not been paying child support, and he wasn't involved in Emily's life. They also thought he would have difficulty hurting Emily because it was his own blood, which would explain why Emily was found unharmed. However, he had an airtight alibi. He was at work that morning. No one was sure if Amy was dating anyone at the time of the murder, but there were rumors that she was seeing a football player who was known for his temper. But he was in class at the time of the murder. Amy's brother gave the police another possible suspect, Trevor Jasper. Jasper was a high school dropout who worked at a fast food restaurant a few blocks from the family's home. Also, a week after the murder, he pawned a graphics equalizer. Jasper also knew the family schedule. The police talked to Jasper's co-workers at the fast food restaurant. They said on the morning of the murder, he left for nearly an hour. When he came back, he was out of breath and acting nervous. After the murder, he talked about the murder, and it seemed like he had inside knowledge of the crime. For example, he knew that there was blood all over the walls. Jasper also had scratches on his arms. The police talked to Jasper's manager, Daniel Brockner. He said that Jasper was shady and thought he was selling stolen goods out of the restaurant. The police questioned Trevor Jasper, and he admitted to trying to sell the equalizer, but he said he didn't steal it. He said that Amy's brother gave it to him before the murder to try and sell it, but he couldn't, so he returned it. Amy's brother confirmed this. Jasper said at the time of the murder, he was at work. He did leave, but he went to a pharmacy to get a prescription. As for the scratches on his arm, he said he got them from work. He even had an explanation for his inside information regarding the murder. He had talked to a neighbor who had overheard the police talking. He then volunteered to take a polygraph exam. It was determined he was telling the truth. The police also confirmed that he had picked up a prescription on the day of the murder. The police didn't drop Jasper as a suspect, but they decided to look at other persons of interest. Trevor Jasper actually gave them another person of interest, his manager, Daniel Brockner. Brockner was late for work on the morning of the murder. The police questioned Brockner, and he admitted they had met Amy before, but he had denied killing her. The other employees said that they thought that Brockner and Trevor worked together selling stolen goods. The police thought it was possible that Brockner and Trevor may have worked together and killed Amy. But none of the evidence the police had at the time could connect either man to the crime. So after a few weeks, the case went cold. Amy's mother, Gloria, ended up adopting Emily. Emily turned out to be a lot like her mother. In high school, she was an honor student. In 2002, 13 years after the murder, the case was reopened. Soon after the case was reopened, a man contacted the investigator. He said that he was psychically connected with Amy. He said that Amy had been coming to him in his dreams. The detective did not believe that, but he did think it was interesting that the man had called. He had lived across the street from Amy, and apparently he had feelings for her. On the day of Amy's murder, he had been sent home from school because he had an episode where he acted out. So he wasn't at school at the time of the murder. He told the cold case investigator that if he told him what he saw in the dreams, that the dreams would stop. The detective didn't believe his dreams had revealed anything. Instead, he thought he was a good person of interest. He knew Amy, lived close to her, and didn't have an alibi for the time of the murder. The detective also thought that the dreams were a manifestation of his guilty conscience. The police had saved the evidence from the crime scene. They were able to make a DNA profile of the killer from the semen stains on the bed sheets. Using the DNA profile, the neighbor was eliminated as a suspect. The cold case investigator then got DNA samples from the other persons of interest. They were all cleared as well. In 2011, a reporter with the Indianapolis Star named John Toohey wrote an article about Amy's murder. After that, a friend of Amy's set up a memorial page for her on Facebook. It had been 22 years since Amy had been killed, and a lot had changed in those two decades. Amy's daughter, Emily, graduated from high school and then attended Purdue University. In 1989, the biggest TV shows were all sitcoms, The Cosby Show, Roseanne, and Cheers. In 2011, the biggest shows were Sunday Night Football, followed by NCIS, and then Dancing with the Stars. 1989's biggest movies were Batman, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, and Lethal Weapon 2. 2011 was similar because the top three movies were all part of massive franchises. They were Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, Transformers Dark of the Moon, and Twilight Breaking Dawn. In 1989, the Academy Award for Best Picture went to Rain Man, and in 2011, The King's Speech took home the award. The top three songs in 1989 were Look Away by Chicago, My Prerogative by Bobby Brown, and Every Rose Has Its Thorn by Poison. In 2011, the top three songs were Rolling in the Deep by Adele, Party Rock Anthem by LMFAO, featuring Lauren Bennett and Goon Rock, and finally, Firework by Katy Perry. One thing that didn't change was Gloria Widener's residence. She had stayed in the same house where her daughter was murdered. The cold case investigator thought that the Facebook page might provide clues or give them a new suspect. But he wasn't familiar with Facebook, so he asked the police force's social media expert, Detective Sergeant Bill Carter, to print the page for him. Detective Carter was intrigued by the case when he found out about it. He didn't know the Widener family, but he grew up close to their home. He and Amy also would have been around the same age. So Detective Carter began investigating the crime himself in his spare time. The only problem was that he never investigated a homicide before. Instead, he worked on nuisance abatement, which means he investigated businesses that violated city laws. Undaunted, he decided to fully investigate the murder. This involved interviewing anyone who knew the family. One person he talked to suggested a man that had never been interviewed. He was 40-year-old Rodney Dink, and he was a friend of Amy's brother. He was 18 at the time of the murder. He was never considered a suspect because he was supposedly at school at the time of the murder. Nevertheless, Detective Carter decided to interview him. In July 2012, Dank wasn't home when he went to his house, so Detective Carter left his business card. Dank called Carter and agreed to talk in a few days. When Carter went to Dank's home, his mother said he had been missing for a few days and they were going to file a missing persons report. Dank had quit his job and emptied his bank account. Detective Carter then looked to see if Dank had a criminal record. It turned out that in 1991, he was arrested for battery, and in 1997, he was arrested for larceny. In 1997, they took his fingerprints and palm prints. He brought the prints to the Lane Prints Department. they compared it to the palm print left on Amy's wall. It was a match. Now, it was just a matter of finding Rodney Dank. It turned out they had rented a car with OnStar, so the police tracked him to an area on the east side of Indianapolis. The police surrounded the area. Dank started screaming that he didn't do it. He then pulled out a knife and quickly slashed his left wrist. He then held the knife to his throat. An officer snuck up behind him and tasered him. Dank was then arrested and taken to the hospital. While handcuffed to a hospital bed, Dank was questioned by the police. He made a full confession. He said that for a few weeks before the murder, he had been coming over to the Widener's home and saw the money Amy had been saving for the new band uniforms. He also wanted the equalizer. On Monday morning, he went to school and checked in for attendance. Then, in between classes, he left and went to the Widener's home, thinking no one would be there. But Amy caught him and confronted him. He then decided to kill her so she wouldn't be able to tell on him. Dank's DNA was then compared to the semen left at the crime scene. It was a match. The police thought that if he committed such a brutal murder, he may have committed other similar crimes. So they entered his DNA and fingerprints into federal and state databases. They were not matched to any unsolved crimes. Rodney Dank made a plea deal. In June 2013, nearly 24 years after the murder, he pleaded guilty to murder. He was sentenced to 65 years in prison. At the time of this video, 51-year-old Rodney Dank is serving his sentence at the Wabash Valley Correctional Facility in Haddon Township, Indiana. His earliest release date is January 2043, when he'll be 71 years old. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Like we said in the intro, if you have a case to suggest, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com, and go to the Suggest a Case page. But that's all for this week. Thank you again for listening. Please take care of yourself and stay safe.